Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. I just spoke with Bill Turkell about his new book, Spark from the Deep, How Shocking Experiments with Strongly Electric Fish Powered Scientific Discovery. This came out with the Johns Hopkins University Press in 2013. Now, this is a really wonderfully engaging book for anyone interested in histories of electricity, histories of electric fish, history of animal experimentation, and also the history of the intimacy between conceptions of life and conceptions of and tools of the electric. So on one level, our conversation follows that trajectory and opens up just a few points of interest that emerge from these wonderful chapters that range from the early use of human engagements with electric fish or the possibilities thereof to 19th century and 18th century experiments to the use of fish to understand nerves and synapses. So there's a lot of really wonderful history here that we kind of touch on as part of the conversation to come. But an equally fascinating part of this book is the process through which Bill not only conducted his research, but manifested in an archive and then wrote about it. And so because one of the things that he's really engaged with and very actively involved with is thinking about and producing sort of workflows and ways of using tools for digital history, you'll also hear in the conversation to come a discussion of how he conducts his research and how he did for this book in particular in terms of a larger field of digital history. We also talk about big history, deep history, and the sort of ways that we can think about and that he thinks about engaging different kinds of archives to tell a story that takes history as it's found in a number of different kinds of sources and disciplinary regimes and weaves them together to tell a larger story. So it's a really fascinating book on a lot of different levels, and I learned a lot from it. So I hope that you have a chance to take a look at the book, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. Thanks for listening. I'm here today to talk with William Turkell about his new book, Spark from the Deep. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Bill, and thanks very much for spending time talking with me today. I'm really looking forward to it.
Hey, so, Carla, thanks very much. Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. So, Bill, can you start us off by saying a little bit about what brought you to the field? How did you come to work on the history of science?
Well, actually, I started off as a programmer when I was a kid, and I kind of put myself through a variety of undergraduate degrees by programming either part-time or full-time and then going to school. And so I studied a bunch of different stuff. I did some kind of human and animal psychology for a while. I switched into linguistics. I did brain and cognitive science. And then at some point, I kind of realized that I would rather be studying science as an activity than doing science or doing experiments. So my advisor at the time kept telling me that no one was ever going to hire a psychologist who went to the library instead of to the lab, and I realized that it was probably a good idea to switch fields at that point. But it wasn't until I was 30 years old that I discovered that I could kind of get paid to read books for a living, so that was pretty sweet.
Isn't that great? It actually sounds really familiar given my experience too. So the book that we're talking about is super cool, and it's a history of the human understanding and use of electricity through the study of strongly electric fish. And we'll talk about what that means and what these strongly electric fish are in the moments to come. So this book also gives readers a framework through this study of the use and conceptualization and experience with and living with strongly electric fish. It gives readers a framework for understanding the origins and the significance of what you call electrophysiological experimentation. So this is a history of fish, it's a history of fish as tools, it's a history of electricity, and it's a history of electrophysiological experimentation. So it works on lots of different levels. So Bill, how did you come to focus on this topic? Can you situate the focus of this book within the larger context of your research and what you've been working on?
Sure. Yeah. And I guess there's kind of a number of levels to that, too, which we can talk about. But the kind of immediate context for it was that my previous book was Among other things, it was environmental history, it was history of science and technology, but the basic question that I looked at in my first book was how people reconstruct various kinds of pasts from physical stuff, from physical evidence like tree rings or geological strata, fish genetics, archaeological sites, all that kind of thing, and why they do that. And in that book, I looked at people kind of reconstructing these various sorts of pasts and then using them in the present to do useful work, to do things like fight over whether or not there should be resource development or the preservation of an archaeological site or the preservation of a particular species of fish or something like that. And that kind of point of view, this sort of combination of environmental history, of the history of science, of the history of technology, of deep time, all of those things were kind of already in my work at that point. But basically the kind of immediate impetus for this was that I was at an environmental history workshop that we organized through NIHE, the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This was, I think we were meeting at Glendon College. We had these nice little workshops where people were going off into rooms and they were thinking about stuff. And I was feeling grumpy because I was thinking environmental history is always about what my friend Alan McEachern calls nuts and bunnies and squirrels. It's always biological things. And I was sitting in this meeting kind of tuning out. I don't remember what people were talking about, but I got to thinking, I wonder why nobody ever starts an environmental history with the sort of physical world rather than the biosphere. You know, I mean, there's stuff about meteorology and weather and stuff like that, but really there's like, you know, one book on those for every 100 books on national parks or something like that. And so a while later, I got to thinking about the ionosphere, and I was thinking, I wonder if you could write a kind of a book about the environmental history of radio and what that would look like. So I started poking around. The story gets weirder. I started poking around as see, you know, has anyone ever done this? And I discovered that, in fact, someone had just written a dissertation on this kind of subject, like kind of human interactions with the ionosphere. And this is a really funny thing. It's a guy named Chenpeng Yang, who's historian of physics at the University of Toronto. But the really funny thing was he was one of the five people in my graduate program in my year in the PhD program. And so I was like, oh, wow, so that's what Chenpeng works on. I never knew. That sounds really cool. And I see that his book on the subject just came out last year. So that's on at the top of my list of fun things to read. Anyway, I realized that Chenpeng had done this book on human ionosphere interactions. But as I was reading about it, I was reading also about the kind of effects of lightning storms on electric fish. And I got to thinking, hey, that's kind of fun. And I remembered kind of from my neuroscience or animal cognition days, I remembered about electric fish, weakly electric fish, their kind of sensory systems and stuff like that. And I started poking around there and looking to see if there might be something interesting.
That's really cool. And coupled with the description that you just gave of how you came to the field as well, of the kind of very interdisciplinary background spanning the sciences and the humanities, and also this interest in constructing pasts from kinds of evidence. And this really makes a lot of sense given the book that we're talking about. And I'm sure as we move through our conversation, listeners will also be able to make those links too. I mean, it's really kind of a perfect project for showcasing that. So the book is all about, on some level, tool making and tool use in various ways as they engage with the issue of strongly electric fish. And since your process in actually creating the book and doing the research for the book is also really, really fascinating from the perspective of tool making and tool use of a researcher actually doing a history, I'm going to ask you a bunch of stuff about that too. And the plane, I'm sure the plane flying overhead right now is like, that sounds awesome, and recording what we're saying. We need to find out what he did to do this research. So definitely I'll make extra sure to ask you about that now too. So in the book, in the introduction, you take us into you kind of lay the groundwork for understanding the chapters that are to come. So you tell us in the introduction, we tend to think about living organisms and electricity as if they occupied different spheres, right? But this separation really only happened in the 19th century. And so we're going to use this study of an engagement with strongly electric fish to sort of trace that genealogy and look at the emergence of that separation as a particular historical moment rather than take it for granted as it shaped this history. Now, the book charts a history of intimacy, really, and intimate connections between electricity and life, as the one was studied for a very long time with the aid of the other in the guise of strongly electric catfish and rays and eels. These are fascinating creatures on their own right. Now, the central argument of the book, and you lay this out in the introduction, is that our treatment of electric fish as apparatus, and our being really human beings broadly writ, allowed us to create and inhabit electric worlds of our own. Okay, so maybe let's dive in and start out by talking about this idea of fish as instruments or tools. Can you kind of open this up for us by just saying a little bit about how did you come to think about this problem in that way? And what do we need to know starting out about how you're conceptualizing fish as instruments for us to then proceed and maybe fully appreciate what's happening later in the book?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, and for me, that was that kind of question about whether I was thinking of these fish as animals, or whether I was or as other animals, or whether I was thinking of them as kind of equipment, was one of the ambiguities that became kind of increasingly clear that was sort of where the real interest in the story for me lay. So basically, lots of other species. The kind of history of interactions with strongly electric fish is a history of, first of all, you know, kind of handling them, then trying to do things with them, you know, whether it's eating them or thinking of their ability to deliver these powerful shocks as some kind of symbolic function. People use them for as long as we know. Basically, these records go back to antiquity, and there's kind of archaeological evidence for these kinds of uses before that, but basically people used the shock of these fishes, which is considerable, for various kind of therapeutic things. So to treat migraine, for instance. But although there's one of the kind of ancient physicians says basically that you shouldn't use the fish, the torpedo in this case, on a person's head too many times in a row, otherwise they might kind of become permanently numb. I know it's just kind of horrifying and yet at the same time oddly compelling reading. But the idea that the cultures of Africa, of the Mediterranean basin, of the South America, were very familiar with these animals, you know, far, far predating human writing, basically. So the early story really has to be figured out from other kinds of evidence than written sources. And this idea that you could do something with these animals, something useful, whether that was conceived of, you know, in kind of magical terms or what, that either way, it's something that was kind of a resource in their environment. And so for me, really, the kind of earliest story is just showing, first of all, that these fish evolved their capability to shock long before people evolved, and that the environment where people did evolve was, these would have been a very salient part of their environment. And really, until the last couple hundred years, the only way that people could kind of reliably and repeatably and non-lethally experience electric shock was by touching one of these animals.
Now, you've mentioned one of the really fascinating things about this book as a product of a process, right? Sort of as a product of a particular set of research and writing decisions and practices, is this engagement with non-written evidence, right? Other kinds of evidence that are not just textual sources. And this brings us, I think, really nicely into the first chapter and the issue of big history. So the book explicitly takes a big history approach to the history of science. Can you sort of talk a little bit about what does this mean to you for you? What are the benefits of, well, what is a big history approach for you? What are the benefits of this in terms of the story that you wanted to tell? And how did you decide to expand out into that kind of scope and scale for this project?
So for me, basically, big history is the idea that we should try to reconcile what we know about the human past, which we construct from mostly from written evidence, but also from other kinds of evidence, whether it's symbolic or it's of other sorts. What we know about that past, we can reconcile with the past that we reconstruct from the historical sciences. So sciences like geology and evolution they're archival in the sense that they collect that it happened one particular way. It's a kind of a research question or maybe a philosophical question about what would have happened if things had gone slightly differently. If you were somehow able to play this tape twice, would you get the same kind of unfolding of plants or animals or geological structures? And so reconciling those two kind of historical but different views of the past is, I think, what makes something a big history. Some people call it deep history. I tend to think of big history as going back to pre-human and possibly prebiotic pasts, and deep history is kind of connecting humankind with their closer mammalian kin, other hominins and stuff like that.
I mean, this is actually, it's really, really, just to kind of take a moment and talk about this in larger terms, and then we'll talk about it in the context of this project. But it's really interesting because more and more, in the reading I'm doing for, you know, podcasts and beyond, I'm seeing more and more people getting interested in taking a kind of big history approach, and explicitly for the reasons that you're saying, right? This sort of, as we're thinking more pluralistically about what constitutes an archive, about what history looks like, right, and where history is, and who gets to write it, right, and what counts as a history, I think there's more and more interest in thinking beyond not just kind of local historiographical approaches in terms of, you know, different language archives, different institutional approaches to historiography, but also looking to what are really historical practices in the sciences and the constructions of an archive by, you know, paleontologists and people who work with the genome and things like that, is, you know, conducting kinds of history and making these histories and these kinds of archives speak to each other. I think it's just really, really interesting. There's a new Max Planck Institute devoted to this kind of way of thinking across histories and sciences as forms of archives and forms of history. And I think there's a really interesting future for this kind of work as well.
Yeah, that's cool. I didn't know about that.
Yeah. I mean, are there other approaches to this kind of big history or deep history that you found inspiring in thinking about engaging this as a framework for this book?
Well, I think the thing, part of what recommends this kind of approach, I think, is that within, you know, the last 10 or 15 years, we've come to take it for granted that we all have always on instant access to the sum of the world's knowledge. And I think it becomes, well, for some people at least, it becomes harder and harder to imagine that these little containers that we used to use, whether it was a region or a particular span of 5 years or a particular language group or whatever, that these little historiographical containers make as much sense as they used to. And I think that the kind of ability to see everything all the time on demand gives us a more synoptic approach to knowledge, to, or at least has the potential to. Not everyone is willing to engage with the fire hose in that sense.
That's right. I mean, I'm seeing also a lot of people in global history starting to engage historical linguistics as sort of part of what they're doing, which is, I think, another kind of area of this kind of experimentation with historiography that's really interesting.
Absolutely, yeah, that's really cool, Phil.
So the first chapter, as kind of an example of what we mean by this big history as it manifests here, the first chapter chronicles the earliest history of human interaction with strongly electric fish from, in part, the earliest pictorial and written descriptions in ancient Egypt. So it's a really interesting archive, and as we'll see when we get to the end of the book, the conclusion will take us back even further, all the way to the Big Bang, right? So it's kind of an amazing and really innovative and inventive way of thinking about scope and archive. So there's a key tenet that you introduce early in the book, and I'll just, I think these are your words, similar regimes recur across different spatial and temporal scales, right? So this is a very thoughtful reason for using this, thinking about similar regimes recurring across different spatial and temporal scales. Now, one of the regimes that becomes really, really important in shaping really what's happening in all of the chapters is something called niche construction theory. Okay? And this, briefly put, is a theory that an organism's activities modify the environment in which it lives, and that this transformation in turn changes the possibilities of its future. So this gets us to the kind of living in an electric world and world making through these fish. Can you talk a little bit about this niche construction theory as you find it useful for thinking through this particular archive? Sort of how did you hit upon this, and why for you did this emerge, or how did this emerge or transform into a key way that you were thinking about this archive?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. So when I first, I mean, when I was originally thinking of this as an environmental, kind of an environmental history project of a sort, one of the key ideas I think that most environmental historians espouse in some form or other, although they're in environmental history, usually goes by the name of a dialectic or something like that. But the basic idea is that people or societies do particular things to and in their environments, and that then has an effect that feeds back on the people or the society. Some things become possible as a result of particular kinds of actions, and some things become impossible. And so that when you think about telling a story of environmental history, you're always talking about not just what effect do people have on their immediate environment, but what effect does the environment in turn have on the people, and so on, back and forth in this kind of feedback cycle. And the time scales on which people often write environmental histories are relatively short or relatively circumscribed in space. And so when I started thinking of this story, when I started thinking how could I tell the story not only of how people came to live in an electric world, but how the fish came to live in an electric world of their own, I knew I was going to have to engage with evolutionary time as well as kind of historical time or deep time. And so I went looking in the evolutionary literature, and I came across this idea of niche construction theory, and it was new to me at the time. And as far as I know, I mean, at the time, this was when I was working on the book, it was probably 3 or 4 years ago, I couldn't find any other environmental historians who had made this kind of parallel between the dialectic of environmental history and niche construction theory in evolutionary theory. But it seemed like such a nice match that I was, you know, quite interested to find that stuff and read it. And then, as often happens, I mean, to me at least, I probably spent months reading up on literature that never actually made it into the book because it was just too much fun to, you know how it goes. It's too much fun to stop reading, and so you end up learning a bunch of neat stuff that you then forget and didn't actually end up citing, but it was awesome at the time.
And this, I think, actually brings us really nicely into another cluster of questions and really fascinating kind of issues about the practice of creating the book. But before I get there, listening to you talk about these issues of big history and sources also makes me think that this is also a really interesting approach from the perspective of how a lot of us who aren't maybe self-identifying as in the field of environmental history have encountered some environmental history literature that, for example, in recent years and maybe not so recent years, talks about the importance of considering histories like from the perspective of non-human actors, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what you're doing here in thinking about and constructing your archive in these very on these multiple levels, right, to include environmental, or to think about the kinds of archives that emerge from these different kinds of sources, is really taking that a step further in a way, and not just sort of asking, you know, how do we give non-human actors agency in the story, but also considering, okay, so what if we thought about what constituted an archive from the perspective of, you know, broadly, you know, roughly speaking, a non-human actor? Well, that archive would have to include other kinds of materials, right? Other kinds of information. So I think this is also a really interesting way of pushing back on the idea of an archive from this perspective, and I hadn't thought of that before. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Super cool. Okay, so sources. So let's use this as a chance to talk about the kinds of sources that went into your research here, and also, you know, how you found and dealt with them, because this is really, really, really fascinating. And selfishly, I just kind of want to hear all about this. So in making the book, just to kind of start out, you talk about the importance of working entirely with digital sources. So maybe can you start us off along this path by talking a little bit about that? Why was it important for you to work with entirely digital sources? And for you, what kinds of opportunities does that open up for the way you're writing history here?
So that's a great question. Well, as I mentioned, my kind of earliest, the sort of earliest background in this stuff really started when I was a teenager, and I learned how to program, and I got interested in electronics at around that time. I didn't really do much with the electronics, but I kept programming kind of continually from then until now. And so even when I was in graduate school in the 90s and early 2000s and working on my first book, I was thinking that the kind of ongoing digitization of everything and the access to the internet and stuff like that, the faster, better, cheaper computers, that all of that would quite quickly remake at least our possibilities for doing kind of any kind of humanistic inquiry history among everything else in that sense. And so really for me, this book was my second book. I already had a tenure track job. In fact, I already had tenure, I guess, when I started writing this book, so that it wasn't really risky for me to stop for, it, as it turned out, about 3 weeks to maybe 3 weeks to a month and try to rethink everything about my own research practice and workflow and writing practice and all of that stuff. And basically what I did was I took everything apart into the sort of smallest pieces that I could think of, and then I auditioned different ways of making them more efficient or more fun or better, faster, cheaper, whatever. And that, as I say, that at that time probably only took me 3 weeks or a month. But I realized that if I kind of did everything digitally, worked only with digital sources, digitized anything that wasn't already digital, and then used computers to do that kind of heavy lifting on everything that didn't require my own care and attention, that would speed things up. And it did. It sped things up ridiculously fast. But not only that, it kind of gave me the power to do things that used to be hard or difficult. So I'll give you a couple examples. One thing that everyone who's ever written a book, at least up until recently, has had this experience, and that is you go and you read a ton of stuff, and then you know that there was an awesome quote or anecdote or whatever that you just absolutely positively have to find. And you can spend weeks or months trying to find that. It's just horrifying. That's one thing that's not a problem if you see something. My kind of motto was, if I looked at something, I made a digital copy and saved it in a way that a computer could look at it the next time. So that was one kind of a thing. A second thing just comes down to the kind of anxiety around what happens if the house burns down or my computer crashes or I lose a copy of this thing. And so having an entirely digital work process, having everything digital, means that it could be kind of backed up hourly. Like, I find writing to be such a painful process that I don't want to lose even 20 minutes worth of struggle getting some prose on the paper. And so having that backed up continuously off-site, you know, so if Godzilla steps on my house, I'm not going to lose my book at least. You know, that was a huge advantage for me. And the other thing, and this is a kind of an after-the-fact thing, but you know, prior to chatting with you today, I just went into my computer and I opened up all of the files the way that I left them, basically, when I sent the last revision off to the press. And everything is here exactly the way I left it. And all my notes, all the pictures, all the sources, I have a things to do list with a whole bunch of things that actually never ended up getting done on it. And I can kind of see where I was at the moment that I wrapped the project and sent it off. And so that sense of being able to kind of resurrect or reanimate, if you want to use metaphors from the book, the whole kind of thinking that went into this thing, that's all right there in the digital sources. But it's way more than that in some sense.
I mean, you talk, let's just continue to talk about this because it's so fascinating and it's so important for understanding what's happening in the book. Like, beyond digitizing sources, you actually talk in the book about the importance of creating an ecology. So again, engaging this and encountering this environmental studies world, right? Creating an ecology of interacting programs to deal with those sources. So for somebody who is compelled by your explanation and justification for doing this and who might want to get started themselves, in the case of this book in particular, what were some of the most important of those programs within that ecology? And can you just kind of open that up a little bit for us?
Yeah, for sure. So basically, the one thing that I did on my previous book, which made a huge difference, was just use some bibliographic software. So whenever I collected a source, I would be disciplined about collecting the citation and saving a copy of the source with the citation. So that's a kind of a key part of anything like this. There's also three other kind of areas that are really important. One of those is in finding sources. So one of the techniques which I use, and you can do this with some off-the-shelf software, or sometimes you want to write your own depending on what you're doing, is you write little computer programs that start with something that you have, a source, and that they extract every bit of information that they can from that particular source. And then they go online and they try to find related stuff. So as a kind of a quick example, you could run a text of any kind. I usually split things into small pages because that works out better. But you run a page through a program and it identifies all the people, all the locations, all the organizations, sometimes the dates, sometimes things like currency values, that kind of thing. And just identifies each of those. And then you can automate the searching. Hyperlinks pulls out hyperlinks. You can automate the searching from that source to other related sources. So if you have a name in an organization, you can automatically fire off a search to Google or whatever that will then return, or in a bibliographic database, JSTOR, or something like that, that will then return sources that are related to that person, that organization, that place, that time, that kind of thing. So the sort of automated, in the background, I kind of constantly have these programs running, searching for stuff for me that might be relevant. So that's one kind of thing. When you have all those sources in digital form, the kind of next level of doing fun things with them is to take something and you can find everything in it that is related to that source. So, for example, I could highlight a paragraph in my notes and I could say, show me everything that's related to this paragraph. Or I could highlight a footnote. This is where it gets really fun. You can highlight a footnote and say, show me everything that's related to this footnote. And because you've kind of intentionally created a small archive on the order of 5,000 or 10,000 sources, when you search for a person's name or an organization or a location or a date, the hits that you get are super relevant. And so I could look, say, at someone's footnotes. I won't name any names here, but some of the historians that I really respected, 20th century historians, have really garbagey footnotes because it used to be really hard to track down every source that a person cited. But if you have those sources and you have the footnote, all of the little errors that people made in their citation and all that stuff, that just is kind of glaring. It just sort of pops out at you. And you see those and you feel like you just know for sure that someone else is going to do this to your book in 5 or 10 years, and likewise, no. You don't want it. Yeah, when I talk to students about this, some of them say things like, I'm not comfortable with the idea of that level of scrutiny. And I'm like, get used to it, because you know what we can do now, soon everyone will be doing. So there's this idea of the techniques there are using things like what are called clustering. And in this is unsupervised clustering. So you use a kind of a statistical measures of similarity between texts so that you don't have to decide that this paragraph is related to these other paragraphs. The software kind of does it for you, and you do what historians have always done, which is kind of close reading, interpreting, writing. That's the hard part. And then and making sense of it all.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that, or did you find that when working on the book, using these, what sounds like really amazing tools for sort of really transforming your workflow, was this did this change the kinds of questions that you were bringing to your sources? Like, did this transform how you were thinking of what you were producing when you were producing a history of this this kind of apparatus, this object?
I think it really does change the way that you write, because in some sense, there's still, like, there's no replacement for the kind of human interpreter, and you know, in history really it's selection and interpretation, basically the writing of history. But the ability to gather sources which may or may not be relevant, and then to have a machine go through and say to you, I think that these are most relevant, or I think that this is what you're looking for right now. You start to make a lot of discoveries that feel very serendipitous. Like it's exactly the thing you needed at that point, or that's exactly the anecdote, or this is something that you couldn't make it up. It's so good, and it fits in so well at the point where you happen to be working. And I think that kind of experience becomes more and more familiar the more you work with these kind of machine tools.
Were there any serendipitous discoveries like that immediately stand out to you that happened when you were doing the research for the Strongly Electric Fish book?
Let me think. That's a good question.
I know, I'm sort of hitting you with this all of a sudden. But
yeah, I'm feeling, you know, actually, I think there definitely are. So basically, one of the things that when I first started looking into the strongly electric fish, you find a lot of stuff about ancient Egypt and the sort of wacky things that the Greeks did to one another using these fish as therapy, that kind of thing. But and I had a sense also from sort of studying history of science, and especially studying with Harriet Ritvo, who works on Darwin and 19th century evolution, stuff like that. I kind of knew that there was a Darwin story in there, but I didn't have nearly the same kind of understanding of or appreciation for the work that had been done in German electrophysiological labs and the earlier work in sort of romantic science. Like, I knew that, in some sense, I knew that stuff was there, but I just really hadn't appreciated the extent of it and sort of how well it would fit in and how interesting it would be.
That's awesome. Thank you. So you do have a website, and I'll link to this for listeners so that they can go and look and explore on their own as well, and maybe sort of try out some of these methodologies. But you have a website that takes us through some of your recommendations for how to construct a workflow that, you know, enabled ostensibly the work for the book and also might enable the work for many other books in many other fields. And it starts with some of the issues that you talked about, right? A backup strategy, making everything digital, using RSS feeds, right? Be doing research, as you put it, 24/7, using right. What you call spiders to collect sources. Is that kind of what you were mentioning before?
Absolutely.
Okay. And then what you call bursting documents. Is that what you meant by breaking up the documents into these little chunks?
Yeah, I'll give you an example of both of those things. So when you go to the web to search Google or Bing or whatever, there is no kind of current map of the web. What you get instead is that the search engine companies send out these little programs, which are called spiders or bots or whatever, and what they do is they download a page, extract all the information off it, index it, pull out all the hyperlinks, and then follow each of those hyperlinks in turn, download all the pages, extract all the links, and so on. If you try to do that on the web, on a web scale, it's a super hard problem that requires more resources than scholars have. But if you do it in a kind of a focused way, if you're looking for something in particular, if you're spidering outwards from a source that's really relevant to you, then you can use these kind of tools to quickly gather a digital archive of pointers and abstracts and full text documents and so on. So that's the kind of spidering bit. What I found was, once I started doing this clustering work on the texts, was that in fact I remember the exact book. It was a 19th century book, which was kind of a timeline, and I think it was called something like, and now I'm just making this up, so you probably won't be able to find this exactly, but I got it from the Internet Archive. It was a 19th century book, and it was called something like A History of Electricity from the Earliest Times to the Present. And basically it was just like a a kind of a timeline that included everything electrical as seen in the late 19th century in this sort of huge encyclopedia type thing. And so what I found originally was every time I did a search or I tried to cluster a paragraph, it would tell me that book was relevant because something in that book was relevant. And I realized that that's exactly the kind of granularity that you don't need. So what I do instead now is if whenever I get a source, no matter how long it is, I keep the original source so I can look back at it and use it for other things. But I also split it into little chunks. And each one of those pages gets indexed on its own rather than indexed as part of this big blob. And so instead of knowing that that book is relevant, I now know that, say, you know, page 373 of that book is strongly relevant to my current interest. Great. So that's the bursting, yeah.
Awesome. And we also talked a little bit before we started recording about other kinds of tools. And I won't belabor this, but just to kind of mention for listeners, you do mention using Scrivener as one of your tools as well. So for the just to kind of talk about the moving from the research to the writing process. And I know they're part of the same process, right? I know we can't really separate them, but you sort of mentioned writing tools and programs that also let us break down our writing into chunks that are manageable, right? Did you find that was really important in or sort of transformative in the kind of writing that you did for Spark from the Deep?
Personally, I feel like just spending the $50 or whatever it was on Scrivener probably doubled my writing speed. So you say, well, you don't know when the research ends and the writing begins. I know it's when it starts hurting because I hate writing. The other part, the reading and thinking, that part is totally joyful. But as soon as I have to start putting words down of my own, it becomes very painful. So, yeah, the ability to write in little chunks and also for me, because I tend not to work from outlines, that was, again, something that Harriet Ritvo taught me, was not to work from outlines, but instead to work from, you know, precis or bits of prose instead. Because I don't work from outlines, it's more of a challenge for me to keep track of how long each chapter should be. And within the chapters, I try to break each chapter up into 6 or 7 little named sections. I think in this book, I'm pretty rigid about breaking each chapter into about 6 little sections. And each chapter is about 12,000 words long. And one of the really nice things about Scrivener is it lets you work in these little tiny chunks that you can rearrange and rethink. So if I'm writing a section and it's getting on for more than, say, 2,500, 2,800 words, then I know that section is getting pretty long and that other sections in that same chapter are going to have to be a bit shorter. And so I think in terms of the pacing of the whole book, like what do the chapters feel like? How long is each one? What's the kind of point that it makes? How long does it take to unfold in real time? How long does it, what kind of transitions? I'm not very good at things like topic sentences and transitions. And so often that's a process that I have to go back in and think about again. Did I make a transition from this section to that section? I also like to have fun, and this is probably just more for my own amusement. I like to have fun doing things like thinking of a section in one chapter mirroring a section in another chapter, or doing something. Sometimes it overturns another section, or reflects on it in some interesting way, or parallels it in a weird way, or something like that. And so there's a lot for me. Like there's a lot of the fun of writing, such as it is, comes in those kind of experiences. Again, I mean, like, I don't know if you know Harriet well. She's a wonderful mentor and friend, and but she says some funny things. Like I remember her telling me on a couple of occasions that she writes first for her own amusement and then for other people. And I know what she's talking about, because there's a sense in which I am having fun with those kind of things, even if getting the prose out sometimes really hurts.
So there actually are, now that you are mentioning, or I'm glad that you're mentioning explicitly this kind of the way that the sections in the different chapters really speak to each other, because it's definitely something that I noticed as a reader, and it's a really, really nice aspect of the book. So one of the things, or one of the kinds of objects that comes up repeatedly throughout, but specifically that kind of comes up in an early chapter, and then we come back to it in a later chapter, is the idea of a battery. Right. So after the first chapter where you set out this deep history, introduce us to sources like fish remains, fossil and tool assemblages, evidence for human migrations that would have enabled the kind of encounters with fish, then you take us into a series of chapters that kind of chronicle, but not, you know, in a straightforward chronological way, really in a wonderfully thematic way, I think, a history of moments of experimentation and tool use and refiguring of the tool, of the fish as a kind of tool in many different ways in different kinds of contexts. So the first context, or one of the early contexts, rather, in which this is happening, is a context in which, sort of as you're putting it here, thinking of the fish as a tool kind of opens up a possibility of building an artificial device that might be able to mimic the shock of electric fish. And here's where we have this emergence of what seems to be a really crucial technology in this book, which is the Leyden jar. Okay.
Right.
So that we can talk about a little bit, you know, just a few specifics to kind of open this up for listeners. What for the book is a Leyden jar, and what's so important for this in the context of the larger argument that you're making about sort of the use of fish as tools and the sort of use of fish in terms of building artificial devices that eventually allow an electric world?
So the kind of, as we were talking about earlier, the kind of people's only experience with what we now think of as an electric shock was handling these fish that were capable of giving them a pretty, you know, a pretty strong jolt. So the least strong of the fishes is described, like being zapped by one of these is described by some diver as like being hit by a very large fist. So you can imagine, and some of the descriptions of the kind of pain and torpor and disorientation and numbness that people feel after being zapped by an electric fish it's obviously a very kind of intense event. In the period leading up to, you know, what we might call the scientific revolution, although, of course, that term is a bit problematic, but in the period leading up to that time, there were a lot of different explanations for how the fish might work. So one of the factors here is that you can sometimes handle one of these fish without getting zapped. So there's a kind of a volitional aspect on the part of the fish as to whether it's upset with you or not. The fish gets exhausted after a while and stops, you know, it stops being able to shock as strongly. But also, because it is electricity, it can be transmitted through things like wet, through salty water, through wet nets or spears, tridents, that kind of thing. And so it's a force that's extremely salient, very unpleasant, that happens only around a few animals, and it's a kind of action at a distance. And so the explanation for what could have possibly caused this, people had lots of different explanations. Is it like a kind of a poison? Is it like a kind of a gas? Is it like a coldness? Maybe that's why you feel numb after touching it, is because it's kind of a coldness. Is it a vapor? Is it a weird effluvium? So there's just tons of different explanations. When people made the Leyden jar, and you can think of a Leyden jar in contemporary terms as kind of a big capacitor, it's basically an object that could store an electrical charge and then discharge it very rapidly when you connect the leads, as it were. And so the reason the Leyden jar was so important was because for the first time, people were able to create a physical object that produced exactly the same kind of sensation as an electric fish and could operate under many of the same kinds of conditions. So it wasn't that it was like poison or it was like numbness or cold or gas or whatever. It was exactly like the shock from a Leyden jar.
Thank you so much.
That was, oh yeah, for sure. That was kind of electrically important, but over the long run, in order to get the most out of electricity as a technology, people needed ways of storing it and releasing it as a steady current rather than as a big blast. And so we don't use Leyden jars per se to store electricity anymore. We use things like batteries instead.
And so from these early chapters, and we're, you know, there's so much in the book and we can't possibly be comprehensive in relating all of it, but just to give listeners a taste so that they can pick up the book and approach it themselves and experience it themselves. But from the early parts of the book, you talk about not only the Leyden jars, but ways of conceptualizing the fish's body as a series of Leyden jars connected in a battery, which brings us ultimately all the way down to, you know, the construction of a battery. And Leyden jars keep coming up. Now, another aspect of what you just said also becomes really, really important insofar as this is a history of not just the use of strongly electric fish as a tool, but it's also a kind of history of sensation, right? Of the production of sensation, of handling, of touch,
yeah.
And a history of intimacy between humans and electricity, and that sort of sensory perception that comes from that intimacy. So the successive chapters, and, you know, again, we won't have time to talk about all of them, but take us through different spaces in which this intimacy is being produced and in which this kind of sensation is being produced and conceptualized at different moments, from electrophysiology, where you talk about, among other things, experiments on electrocuting rather larger and larger animals and also cells, right? Humans.
Right, exactly, like, yeah.
Batteries of Leyden jars. And so there's, like, you know, there's all kinds of funky stories here with, you know, Volta experiments with electric shocks on himself. Alexander von Humboldt is doing electrical experiments with torpedoes. There's a lot of discussion of kinds of therapy and medical experimentation here. And you bring, that brings us into a chapter that looks, among other things, at the use of electricity to shock people. So not just large animals now, sort of horses and frogs and people and living people, but also the use of electricity to shock dead people back to life, or at least to try to do that.
Right.
There's a lot of really interesting cases in here. What are some of your favorite cases, maybe one or two of your favorite cases of this, and or sort of what for you is important about these experiments to shock people back to life in terms of this larger argument that you're making with the book?
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, one of the things that was so interesting for me was this aspect that you mentioned of the kind of intimacy of this, because it's not just, as you say, it's not just a kind of an external or objective story about fish or about technology, about electricity. It's really the story about people hurting themselves over and over in some cases, and hurting other organisms in an attempt to figure out what this kind of mysterious fluid is and how it works. And so for me, one of the kind of most engaging things, but also obviously one of the most disturbing things, was was people's kind of willingness that you see over and over here, in this particular context, their willingness to kind of build apparatus that includes themselves, that includes how they feel when they touch something, that includes other animals, that includes vivisected animals or pieces of animals or heaps of frog legs that have just been severed from the animals' bodies, that kind of thing. Just really, really kind of these very heterogeneous assemblages of person, animal stuff, and machine. And for me, the kind of one of the really interesting questions that kept coming up was the ways that they used these things, including kind of sentiment or intimacy with the machine, as a way to try to figure out where the boundaries are between people and animals, between other animals, between animals of all kinds and machines, between people and machines, and also between the living and the dead. So there's a kind of a chapter in the middle that explores the use of electricity for resuscitation. And we now take for granted things like the kind of defibrillating electrical paddles that kind of restart your heart. But those came from somewhere. And the somewhere that they came from was a lot of gruesome electrocution experiments done with chickens and horses and goats and that kind of thing. There's, in addition to that kind of resuscitation story, there's also this kind of reanimation or attempted reanimation story. So ranging from things like trying to bring back to life someone who's just drowned, to taking the bodies of recently killed people in the French Revolution, recently executed criminals in Britain and stuff like that, and zapping the heck out of them to kind of, in some sense, almost see if you could bring them back to life. Or just I mean, just as a very gruesome demonstration, as kind of a bullock's head is cut off and zapped, and it behaves just like a recently hanged criminal's head when you zap him. So that were, you know, recently guillotined a victim of the French Revolution, and take the heads and cart them away and zap them with electricity and get the eyelids to twitch and the face to form a gross rictus, that kind of thing. But there's also in the same kind of chapter, there's also this idea of the electrical creation of life. And so there's this business with Cross in 19th century Britain, where he subjects this rock to an electrical current and then discovers all of these little animals crawling around on it. And it becomes kind of accepted among at least some circles at the time an electrical creation of life has been demonstrated. And so even though people like Darwin or Faraday have no kind of time for this because they think it's, you know, obviously bogus, at the same time, there's a thought that the first life, the kind of abiotic, if you frame it in terms of Darwin or the evolutionary works before him, there's a sense that electricity has to play some role in the kind of creation and evolution of life. And so there's a lot of really interesting kind of threads that go back and forth, you know, ranging from the shocking or gruesome to these more kind of esoteric things.
That's right. There's actually a whole chapter devoted to looking at evolutionary theories as they engage these fish in these practices. And for listeners who are interested in that part of the story too, chapter 5 looks at the vestiges and also looks at Darwin, among other things, and Faraday, and in particular, Darwin's puzzling over the electric fish. Like, how could these organs arise, like these electric organs as he's understanding them, in the fish without apparent precursors? So there's a really interesting story here as well about the engagement of these problems and these apparatus with the emergence of ways of thinking about and practicing evolutionary theory. There's also, and so now I'm blitzing through, so listeners should know there's a whole range of really fascinating stories, right? I mean, there's so much happening in these chapters. There's a whole chapter on the concept of electric or animal electricity, electrophysiology. So in that chapter, you'll meet Dubois-Raymond with his frog interrupter. There's a machine for studying electric catfish. And sort of a machine for collecting its electricity. There's a whole discussion of the use of animal parts for studying electrical equipment. There's just this wonderful range of stories from the 19th century and beyond. Now, you also talk here about, and I want to make sure that we talk about this a little bit, you also talk in Chapter 7 about the use of electrical fish as model systems. Now, because animals as model systems, this is such an important topic within the history of science. Let's just spend at least a few moments on this. Now, you talk about the use of the torpedo, for example, as a model system for studying nerves and right. synapses, which is really interesting in part because this is a moment where the story moves from a history with touch to really a history of touch, right? The sort of, there's this so many levels in which this sort of felt sensation and intimacy becomes part of the story. And here it becomes part of how we understand nerves themselves, right? And how they create sensation. So right. Would you talk a little bit about this part of the story, the electrical fish as a model system, and for you, what's really interesting about this moment in the story?
So for me, I guess, so there's a couple things that happen towards the end of the book. One is that we mentioned that Darwin had this difficulty in trying to explain how these strongly electric fish could have arisen, because he couldn't imagine in his context what use it would be to have a kind of a weakly electric system. But in the mid-20th century, there is a discovery that, in fact, there are a lot of fish are capable of sensing electric fields, and some of them are capable of generating these weak electric fields for communication and for sensing and stuff like that. So that's one of the, in some sense, getting to the weakly electric fish was one of the things that I was thinking as I was kind of exploring the uses to which people put electric fish and also the kind of relationship with electrophysiology. The other thing that happens, and this is, in some sense, it's a kind of a parallel story, is that the ongoing kind of technological developments in electricity, and this is the stuff that you would typically find in a kind of a history of physics approach to electricity, that these lead to technologies that are much more subtle, that allow people to perceive electrical events that are very, very weak and occur very quickly. They're transient, they're weak, and they need to be, there's this kind of whole story of, first of all, the kind of amplification and perception of those signals with various kinds of tools that eventually result in the oscilloscope. And there's also the idea that not only electricity can be put to useful work, but that the kind of newly discovered electrons themselves can be put to work. And this is where, in the early 20th century, electronics branches off from electricity. And so part of the story for me that was really interesting about what's going on with these fish is they do serve as model systems in a number of different ways. And it goes in kind of different directions. In some, for the strongly electric fish, it's in part due to the specialized muscular and neural tissues that allow them to deliver these big blasts of electricity. But there's also a kind of a sense in which, having experienced these fish for so long and lived with them and in some ways tried to build kind of technologies that come from them, that the descendant technologies, especially the electronic ones, then allow us to learn far more things about these fish than we otherwise would have known. So that the kind of, from the mid-19th century to the mid-late 20th century, the story for me is really one of about this idea that electrons themselves, in the sense of electronics rather than just electricity, become a kind of a universal currency into which all other measurements in the world can be translated. And if you think of something like your like a smartphone today, a smartphone or a new car or something like that has hundreds of different sensors in it that translate all different kinds of things into a very small and weak electrical signal or an electrical charge, electrical current, voltage. So these kind of electronic measurements become literally analogs of stuff that happens in the physical world. And that this kind of the sort of electronics, the rendering into electronics of everything and then rendering it back out is what kind of underlies our sort of electric and electronic world. And so that, for me, that was really the story. The fish don't serve as models for that. I mean, they serve as model systems in some sense, but it's kind of more this interaction with the fish that gives us this rich electric world that we ourselves live in. And I kind of wanted to sort of get to that point before I wrapped up the book.
And speaking of wrapping up the book, this wouldn't be complete unless we got there, right? So the conclusion actually takes us out to, I mean, you go all the way out to the Big Bang in the conclusion, right? So speaking of big history, this is pretty massive and pretty big. And it's a really, I think, powerful way to end the book and to sort of bring us back at the very end. Do you want to maybe talk just a little bit about that, the sort of what's happening in this conclusion as you're moving out in this way?
Yeah, so one of the kind of there's a couple of exemplars of big history that have been very influential, like David Christian's Maps of Time. And so one of the kind of characteristics or hallmarks of big history in that formulation is to start the story at the Big Bang and end it in the present or end it in the near future or something like that. And as I was thinking about this book, it kind of occurred to me that I did still want to get that whole sweep into the story, but instead of framing the whole book that way, I framed the book on a kind of a slightly tighter time scale that includes other hominins and stuff like that. It comes into the present. So, you know, only a few million years. And then for the conclusion, I would then situate that story in the kind of longer term story that runs from the Big Bang to the present. And that in that, really what I try to get to in the conclusion is that there's a sense in which everything that's alive is living in an electric world. And that's because, well, first of all, everything that's kind of big is held together with electromagnetic forces. There's everything that's alive makes use of basically of electrons that have been excited and then are kind of returning to a ground state via a pathway where you can extract a little bit of work from them. So there's a sense, there's that sense in which things are alive. There's a sense in which animals of various kinds are able to perceive electric forces or geomagnetic ones and that kind of thing and so on. So there's, I try to fit the whole sort of previous book basically into a much longer time scale that kind of points out, first of all, how pervasive electric worlds really are, and at the same time tries to kind of bring some of the themes together.
Great. So, Bill, there's a ton of material. Well, first of all, thank you so much. I mean, there's a ton of material in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, and there's a much, much richer conversation we could have that could span hours if we had them. But since we don't have them, is there anything in particular, either about the sort of methods that produce the book or about the content of the book itself, that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
No, I mean, I think we did basically a good job of kind of conveying what sort of a book this is. You know, if you're interested in animal experimentation, if you're interested in electrical or electronic technologies, if you like weird medical stories or natural history stories, then probably you'll find something that's fun there. And if not, you know to avoid the book and perhaps move on to something you like better.
So speaking of moving on, now that the book is done, and congratulations on the book, this has been super fun to talk with you about, and it was super fun to read. And also, I've learned a lot, both about electricity, big history, and also about what it means and what it can look like to produce a book. What's next for you? Are there any projects right now that are particularly exciting or inspiring you?
So I am working on a couple of kind of content-related projects. So one is about, I've been working on this idea that people could build, or the people or natural systems could build a machine that was capable of making a copy of itself. And so over the past 5 or 6 years, I've done a lot of building of things like 3D printers and other computer-controlled machine tools. I've also been working on kind of histories of electronics proper. So this the sort of story that I hint at in this book. I'm kind of interested in exploring those 20th century stories about the history of electronics. In terms of method, a lot of my recent work has been focused on doing things with kind of computer-assisted use of visual images, of kind of using techniques from computer vision and image processing to automatically go through sources and extract all of the images to classify them automatically into things like photographs and drawings and so on. Wow. And then in terms of things like the electronics, to pull out the things that are electronic schematics and to try to break those down and do some machine understanding on those. And so that's a kind of a current area for me and for a few of my students and colleagues is engaging basically with the enormous amount of visual evidence that's being created now digitally on a kind of day-to-day basis. Supposedly something like 1 billion photographs are uploaded to Facebook every few days. And if you think about those as sources for future historians, we're definitely going to need machine-assisted image mining just the same way that we now, you know, those of us who are in digital history are now using text mining. And so that's really methodologically where my work has been.
Awesome. Well, best of luck with all of that stuff. I'll look forward to talking with you about the next book when it's out in like 3 weeks, four weeks.
Exactly. Yeah.
And thanks so much, Bill. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.